welcome to the fourth edition of the Young Radisol podcast with me, Matt Sharp, and I'm joined with Wes Brown once again.
Hello, Matt Sharp and listeners.
And this week we're joined by Nathan Connolly as well, who's come to be interviewed by us. How are you doing?
I'm right, thanks.
Nathan will be interviewed by me and Wes later on, but we'll have one quick question to begin with. Nathan, what shoe size are you?
10.
About you, Wes?
I'm about a 9.
I'm a 12. Never trust a man who doesn't tell you his shoe size. That's my motto in life.
I'm sure that has saved you many times. Many scrapes.
More than I care to mention. Anyway, it was that by thanking Kyra Brennan last week, who gave us an interview. And good sport. Thank you very much for that. Once again, you can email us at the Young Writers Club Podcast at hotmail.co.uk. If you want to ask us any questions, any suggestions, any comments or interesting ideas or anything really, just email us and we'll get back to you, and hopefully we'll get you on the podcast. Shall we start where we usually start, with what we've been doing, what we've been reading? So Wes, what have you been doing?
I've been reading all sorts of little bits and bats lately. I've been into Raymond Tallis a lot, who's regarded as one of the top 100 polymaths in the world, so he's an intellectual who's brilliant in a number of fields. He's a professor of gerontology at Manchester University. He's a poet, he's a novelist, he's a philosopher, and among other things. He's written a very interesting book about evolutionary theory and the reductions that he makes, or his claims about humans and human agency and free will and human potential. And also reading his attack on theory, on literary theory, and some of the nonsense that people have been spouting. And aside from that, I've been reading Public Enemies, which is the dialogue, the letters between the French author and author Michel Houellebecq and the French philosopher Henri Lévy. Henri Lévy was the man responsible for getting Sarkozy to intervene in Libya. That's how powerful a philosopher he is in France. And it's in part a vain, egotistical, pompous, bombastic, but at times revealing, interesting, and witty dialogue between two interesting thinkers.
The only sort of French philosophers I really know were from the French Revolution, like Rousseau. So, yeah, not bad. You're intellectually reading intellectually recently, then?
Just how I roll.
Sweet. Yeah, well, I'm not intellectual, so I've been reading Game of Thrones, the fourth book of that series. It's very good, actually. I'm quite enjoying it. So fantasy is a historical fantasy in the sense that it deeply influenced my history, and it's interesting, like, looking at all these fictional characters and trying to draw comparisons with based on historical characters. But I talk about genre fictions later on, obviously, but I've also been reading, I reread The Great Gatsby the other day, just to remind myself how good that actually is. The first time I read it, I wasn't too much impressed, but I don't know, maybe I've matured into it.
I felt the same a little bit, actually, but Fitzgerald's having a bit of a renaissance lately. Yeah. More people pro-Fitzgerald than Hemingway these days. It used to be the other way around.
I found this on the Guardian website, actually, so it's not from the Young Writers Club itself, but I was reading that Bret Easton Ellis, the author of American Psycho, is considering writing a sequel to American Psycho, and it may be reminisce and about that whole 90s era of blank fiction and Chuck Palahniuk and Bret Easton Ellis, the nihilist American movement, and it seems sort of gone, hasn't it? Just trying to reminisce about the whole nihilist American movement, which I know you're kind of interested in as well.
Yeah, I like all those authors, particularly when I was younger. And American Psycho and Less Than Zero, fantastic novels.
Yeah, I've not read Less Than Zero.
No, it's really good. He was only 18 or 19 when he wrote it.
There's been a lot of book adaptations as well, which are taking sort of those older themes that have shown up in books, but now are being translated to film. So you've got things like Revolutionary Road, which was translated sort of post 9/11, and that's all about questioning that American dream And you've also got things, the Coen brothers translating, I forget what it's called now,
No Country for Old Men,
which is very much about a sort of lack of direction, searching, and with the road as well, that's at its heart a story just about a father and son played against a sort of very chaotic background, and there's a lot of stuff there about just finding identity and finding sort of pathways and direction.
But also I think there's a laziness to a lot of the adaptation, not for Cormac McCarthy, when I suppose it's a great film, but there's a real laziness and an exhaustion in cinema where, you know, I used to work in the cinema and almost everything is a remake or a sequel or an adaptation from a successful book or TV series or something like that. So it's kind of like, and I think in some ways that Bret Easton Ellis is a novelist who's not done anything pretty much since American Psycho. And the cynic in me thinks that he's just trying to go back to old hunting ground.
I think American Psycho is a very, very good book, but you're probably right, seeing he's not done too much since.
But, you know, it could be completely inspired. It could really work. And careers and reputations go up and down, you know. Okay, my news story of the week comes from the Narwhal website, which is there's a new prize for radical writing. It's called the Bread and Roses Award, and it's specifically for sort of radical left-wing writing and books. And I think it ties into a new demand for radical alternatives. And that's, I'm not saying that's not necessarily right or true, but we're in a mainstream now where the political consensus is pretty much discredited by most people. People are now starting to look at alternatives. Books like Owen Jones' Chavs and Penny Red by Laurie Penny are gaining a sort of momentum. And there's the Occupy movement as well that sort of brings in a lot of radical ideas, although it's effectively useless and doesn't have a programme of action. But it's a kind of protest aesthetic. It's the protest in itself. It's a kind of artistic gesture, which is interesting. And I think this work applies in publishing too. It's been very cautious and very boring and very mainstream lately. And there's new startups and so on, maybe a bit like the Nightlight that Nathan's going to discuss later, who are publishing in different ways and developing audiences and authors in radically different ways as well. And sometimes the content can be different or radical, and sometimes it's the approach which is radical. It doesn't really matter. And I think this is quite a curious new development.
Yeah. In terms of the political climate, it certainly suggests something like a disillusionment of the established political parties, at least, and the want for reform, especially the Occupy movement, I think ties in perfectly what you mentioned there.
Laurie Penny's writing on the Occupy movement is something that I followed when she was writing in the New Statesman, and I'm really excited to see Laurie Penny there, because her writing there, I think that was some amazing journalism. And she really got to sort of the core about what that movement was about and what was driving it, rather than about sort of what sort of effect they could have or how important they were. She sort of left that behind and went at sort of what were the motivations of those people. And I think I'm just really happy to see that she's in there, because she's a journalist whose work I've been really excited about as a sort of new voice.
I don't know if you, there's a podcast by Greg Proops called The Smartest Man in the World podcast. He's spoken a lot about the Occupy movement and how the main media sources in America particularly have discredited it, having no idea, no constitution behind it. But
the interesting thing is part of a backlash from the centre-left as well, the centre-left. I mean, you'd expect it from the right, but there's a lot in the centre-left.
Centre-left being Labour.
Well, in America as well, where it's not strictly a centre-left in our terms, because Obama's probably just to the right of Cameron. But, there's a lot on the left who have kind of been annoyed by the Occupy movement. See, it's just a little bit bratish.
I think it's a nervous sort of reaction to sort of more popular sort of engagement with politics, and the form that engagement's taking isn't with the establishment, and I think they see that. I mean, even with them being the left, it exposes them as not being left. It exposes them in a sort of Emperor's New Clothes kind of way about their politics and their policies and where the actual consensus of the public is, rather than the sort of representation where the public.
Yeah, it's funny as well that some groups like the Revolutionary Communist Party, who have got quite a mixed reputation, but they dislike the centre-left more because they still see it as propping up an establishment, except giving the illusion of reform or that kind of thing, when it's just sort of sedating people into a system which they think is inherently wrong. And it's not an analysis that I agree with, but it's an
interesting to be said for the analysis of, if you have a left party, then it drives people to vote for that lesser of two evils rather than a party that actually reflects them. And I think that is a part of the failings, and why I was particularly disappointed with the sort of election reforms that were proposed and voted on here. That would have gave a chance for people's political opinion to be represented in a better light rather than just in a sort of, in a first-past-the-post system where people side with whoever's more likely to win that's going to be the lesser of their evils.
The main topic of this podcast is the idea of fiction and genre fictions and how we define a genre and if one is better than the other or one is different enough from the other to have a separate category in itself or fantasy.
Yeah, it's a bit of a tricky one because it matters about your definitions. Where generally, if you say, I mean, there are plenty of literary novels that are just bad. Being literary or being called literary in itself isn't a guarantee of quality. But generally speaking, most genre fiction plays by its conventions. It's quite strict in its rules and in its audience and its expectations. And it generally relies on, it's more plotty. The characters are tend to be stock characters.
Mm-hmm.
And it's generally intended for entertainment. Whereas literary fiction, I would say, can incorporate aspects of genre. You can have sci-fi that I think could be classed as literary, particularly people like Margaret Atwood and J.G. Ballard and so
yeah,
on.
Yeah.
But the literary thing, I think, is intended more as art. And it's not necessarily instant gratification, and it might be more difficult, but it's intending to express something new or challenging or insight about the world in that particular form and isn't necessarily just for entertainment.
I don't think I would discredit as like a science fiction piece from someone like Neil Gaiman or something for being well-written or... Like...
Yeah, but there are some crossover ones. There's a guy who writes literary fiction and science sci-fi in two different names.
That could be
The Wasp Factory.
Oh, I don't know.
Ian Banks. So you get somebody like Ian Banks who writes literary fiction and science fiction, except he makes the distinction himself by writing in different names. But yeah, there are people who I think who work within a genre who don't just do the usual genre stuff.
Well, the first name I came up with that sort of fits that description is probably H.G. Wells.
Yeah, yeah.
He's very much acclaimed for the science fiction fans, but he's also well established with the modernist movement.
And some like Aldous Huxley as well.
Edgar Allan Poe. Well,
I mean, Edgar Allan Poe pretty much invented detective fiction and horror in a modern sense.
There's a little question I'm not entirely sure of the answer, so I may as well put it out there to see if there could be an answer. If a writer starts writing in a genre, say Agatha Christie writes a detective series all of her life, do you think it's been reclaimed as a literary source, or is it...?
I don't think Agatha Christie has.
No.
I think some of P.D. James might have.
I think there's an issue with people like Stephen King, who's always been a genre writer, but at times has tried to break out of that. Mm. And a lot of his work goes discredited because of the attachments he has. But if you, there are novels of his which definitely have literary quality, and I think there are also some novels which are part of, make up so much of their genre that they take on a literary quality, I think. But there's also novels that he's written which aren't genre novels, and if they came from someone else, probably would be given a lot more recognition. And for a time, he wrote under a different name to try and do that.
Do you think being a genre writer is a stigma?
I think it can be in when you're sort of trying to get into those intellectual circles. But I don't think it should be. I'm a big fan of Stephen King. And it's something, you know, I don't put in prize place on the bookshelf because there is that stigma attached and it's ridiculous.
Well, for me, some of the stigma is justified because, generally speaking, there is a difference between what we call literary fiction and genre fiction. And it's a difference between art and entertainment, generally. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But then people get sort of in a bit of a huff because they somehow see entertainment as...
I don't want to discredit one in favour of another.
I think we can do. I would say that literary fiction is more valuable than genre fiction.
It certainly has more life after it's been written. So we just talk about Great Gatsby. How often has that been put up in someone's top 10 favourite books?
I mean, as a literary novelist, I'm going to say this, but something like Middlemarch or The Great Gatsby or Hemingway's great novels or Virginia Woolf's great novel, I think this is really important, valuable stuff. These are real treasures, and we should acknowledge that, but that doesn't mean you have to discredit everything else.
What about things such as Frankenstein or Dracula?
Yeah.
Where they're very much genre books, and their literary quality comes from them being that genre.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
No, I think the opposite, that they are genre books, but they're written well enough to be literary.
But I think also a lot of their charm comes from them being so defining of their genre.
I think they're definitely literary novels.
Dracula and Frankenstein in particular have gone so far as defining the genre itself.
Yeah. Okay, how about something then, Tolkien and The Lord of the Rings, where I don't see much literary quality in there, but they are literary novels in that they've defined their genre so much and they're so important to their genre.
Does that make them literary? I think there's the pretense of literary with Tolkien, but it's never really achieved. He's a good fantasy novelist.
Well, some say The Lord of the Rings is all about the nuclear bomb or the...
One of the footfalls is literary, the term is so often confused with sort of distinction and merit.
For me, I use literary as a mark of quality, generally speaking, so a genre novel can be a literary novel, but most aren't. Most of them just play to the usual conventions and are essentially 300-page cliches.
But I also dislike the attitude of
An establishment
and that sort of snobbish way of not valuing entertainment for its also artistic merit. And I mean, it's a lesser artistic merit, perhaps, or... Even that statement is a bit snobbish, but I think we need to give more credit at times to genre writers, and a lot of developments which are taken by literary writers come from genres.
No, I think it's good, but then I've met a lot of inverse snobs who have got some sort of real problem with literary fiction and actually kick it to bits and say that, you know, genre is better anyway. And I think when we get into that sort of condition where to make any sort of values is just seen as horribly elitist, and meanwhile the inverse values are taken on. But when it comes to for people reading, I'm not going to force anybody to, but I would always encourage people to read, you know, the great novelists that we like, or even Ian McEwan ahead of just your sort of run-of-the-mill Mills and Boone types, or, you know, just a really basic airport thriller.
Is it not the argument that a genre novel can be so under the radar that they can imply something radical or society-changing?
Well, it doesn't necessarily equate to artistic merit, which is I think we should always judge books on artistic merit and not for ideological
reasons. It's such a loose term, though, the merit of someone's
I don't think so. I think that's the whole purpose of critique.
It's the difference between you of opinion that you like this person, I don't like him that much.
Yeah, but because people have different opinions doesn't mean that no opinion is true. We're too afraid to disagree, or but we just always got to be suspended in a sort of value-free territory in case we upset or offend anybody, or even make a value judgment.
And there's something to be said for the sort of from that conflict of arriving at, you know, you often find you have a great argument with someone about something like a book, and it influences your own opinions. And,
yeah, definitely.
You know, you arrive at new conclusions, and you have to have that conflict with them to call each other names and say they're wrong about Harry Potter.
You find that about stuff as well, and it's easy sat in a room if you're an academic or a literary author, just to go, okay, this objectively, I would say this is better than this, but if you're out there working 5 days a week, you're trying to do something on the side, you've got a family, that's a different... You don't want to sit down and read Tolstoy then. You might really just want to read Twilight.
So, come to the interview now with Nathan Conley. How do you describe your role as the nightlight in the nightlight?
I'm one of the partners there. There's three or four of us who run it. And a sort of team of editors that involves us and a few more people. I think we're up to about six editors in total now. I fill in a role as an editor there, and I also sort of run it on a bit more of a behind-the-scenes level as well with the other guys who are partners there.
So it's very much a grassroots place. It started from you and a few others, and it started to go.
Yeah, it started with just two of us, and from there we've sort of other people have joined. Whenever we've got a feeling from someone that they're on board with it, and have got the same outlook as us, and thought they could bring something to us, so we've grown, and there's sort of a core group of us which are do the main work, and then in keeping it going, and then right now we're opening it up again to more editors, and that's sort of we find we can. The more people we get involved, the more interesting it gets, because there's more opinion there, there's more, like we were saying before, a good argument can take you places.
You mentioned having the people with the same outlook, and bearing that in mind, what would you say is the motivation behind that light? Is it just...
Originally, the motivation was born from... I just finished university, wasn't really getting a job anywhere, struggling a bit and feeling a bit down on myself.
Yeah.
And my friends, we wanted to get something going where we were in charge, we were calling the shots, not in an authoritarian way, but in a way that, you know, something with our stamp on it, something that was ours. And we were having, you know, we were putting our voice to the crowd, and that's how it started. And then since then, it's become a sort of, I don't know, a support group for disjointed individuals who want to get involved, and we've also it's very much a motley cooperative of people not accepted anywhere else.
Sweet. The motivation is clearly just came from wanting to do something, and the forum obviously for anyone who wants to start somewhere is the internet, right?
Yeah, the motivation was kind of just a lot of energy we had that was kind of going to waste and being bottled up.
Well, why the internet specifically?
Originally we intended it, we wanted to do a sort of Grand Tour-esque thing of a book anthology, sort of on a quarterly or twice yearly basis, and to make something really sort of pretty and beautiful and handmade, and we quickly realised that we couldn't afford that. Which sort of led us to the internet, and I think it was the wrong way to approach thinking of it just as a money saving thing, but because what we've learned is that it's a medium whereby we can do things with our resources which we would never have the chance to do if we had to go down traditional routes with making things in sort of hard copy. It's very liberating.
Yeah, because you call the shots, you decide what's going on there.
Mm-hmm. That, and it's opened us up to a network of people we never would have met who have all been able to bring their expertise. And this whole thing has been about sort of getting people involved and connecting people. And, you know, we're publishing other people's work and, you know, they're doing us a favour, we're doing them a favour, and we're forming sort of collaborations as we go and networks. And that just wouldn't have been open to us before the internet, I guess.
Yeah, I'm a big advocate of internet publishing and digital publishing, because it opens up networks and communications between different groups. With that in mind, you're starting to consider cooperative publishing with people like Dead Ink and other people as well?
Yeah, an idea that's come up recently, which we're starting to get, starting to look into funding for and ways of setting this up. It's the Nightlight working with, it's not the Nightlight at the moment. It's myself is working with Wes Brown and Adam Lowe to try and set up what we termed the coalition. And that's kind of the idea of that, is it for it to be a sort of umbrella group, sort of agent, which micro publishers like the Nightlight, like Dead Ink, like the Cadaverine, like Pluto or Doghorn join. And we publish, so we publish independently, but what happens is we all feed it into this larger group with the idea of a sort of pooled weight to act as a much larger publisher, when in reality we're still very loose and small and versatile, but we're able to open up sort of doors which would be too heavy for much smaller publishers to open.
Strategically, that makes sense. The safety numbers, try and build up a group of people, like-minded groups, especially like young people like you are, with other young people, the new voice coming through, what is what we want to do, challenging the establishment, if that's what you want to do.
Well, yeah, we're trying to just get this sort of very basic set up at the minute, and then we're hoping it's going to be something that's going to be open to membership for other small publishers. There'll be a slight selection criteria that people will have to meet before they can apply, but with the idea that it's something which supports the sort of direction we all need to think. We're all starting to think we go into not. We don't want any members that are exploitative, or it to be about self-publishing or anything. It's going to be for sort of micro organic publishers, and just a way for them to band together, have a collective voice, and a bit of that sort of collective bargaining power, so that we can keep the power of being small, but also use some of the power of being big.
The future possibility of publishing your own stuff in print as well?
Yeah, hopefully that would be something which would be very difficult for us with our size as we are, but we're hoping that because of the sort of connections and the channels which are going to be open to us once we have members in this group. This is something which Adam Lowe has been really supportive of. Then we would also have those channels open to everyone involved, so that we would, to all anyone on the outside, we would look like a very large publisher.
Mm.
But from our side, we're actually a sort of very rhizomatic group of small organic operatives.
Okay, well, let's move on to Nightlight itself. I had a poke around last night looking at some of the blogs and some of the writings. It seems very interesting, there's some of the stuff you're like producing. I also read Wes Brown's short stories on this, like, it's interesting enough. But yeah, it's some interesting stuff. There's a lot of creative writers out there who are looking for somewhere to put their work out for the wider world. How would your selection process be, or how would you...
We've been very keen with the Nightlight never to pin down sort of what we're looking for. We've never wanted to go about it that way. We've never wanted to say we publish literary writing or like this, or we publish stuff of, you know, with a specific aim. We've always wanted it to be some that our sort of image that comes across by what we're publishing to be something which develops on its own naturally, so that if anyone looks around our site, they get an idea of what we're about. And they might see that there's a space there for them, and they're always free to sort of submit their work to us. Behind the scenes, the way the selection process works is sort of without getting into the admin of it all, then any one editor is free to put up something they like. We tend to discuss things and talk things over, but we've also been keen to give each of our editors a sense of independence and a power to, you know, veto things and say, look, guys, I like this, I'm putting it off. But because, you know, like I said, that thing about arguing with each other again always comes down to, we will argue over the things we're publishing, and we hope that through that we create this sense of identity between ourselves, and then that just organically comes through the website by what's coming in and what we're putting out.
So you publish short stories, poetry, reviews?
We don't do reviews.
Sorry.
We've always tried to stay away from that strict review thing. We're looking at doing some sort of regular columns on there, but we've never wanted to do the straight review thing of just getting something and hawking yourself just to, you know, it seems a bit like hustling.
Yeah.
We've always tried to go about it making things more interesting. We publish short stories, plays, poems. We also were artwork. We do art, but we've neglected it a bit. We're trying to sort that out now. We're taking on a new editor who's going to be doing that, and we're really hoping that's going to be exciting. We've also always tried to collaborate with those things and make them mix up a bit. With our readings, we've started to mix live music in and improvisation and things like that. So we've always tried to blur those boundaries and make sure that nothing's too strict, and that we're always able to react to things and do things which we want without breaking any of our own rules. So we never gave ourselves any rules.
It's a very, very good website. I really would recommend it to our listeners to check it out, read some of the stuff on there, and I imagine you'd be open to taking submissions to anyone.
Yeah, at the moment, things are getting quite exciting. We're going to be open to take submissions. We're always open to take submissions. But we're not going to be publishing now for a while, until I think May. That's just because we're reorganising everything on our end. As I said, taking on more editors, getting it so that we're a bit more organised, because we're terrible at it in the moment. And also, we're starting a lot of other projects. We're going to be doing a monthly reading in Manchester. That's going to be taken every month. There'll be details of that to follow through our site. And also, we're going to start on a programme whereby we're going to be taking another step, and we're going to start releasing our e-books now and working with some of our authors that we're more familiar with, and releasing sort of full-length works by them in digital format. And that's something which will hopefully be released by us and hopefully feed into the coalition as well. And that's just a step we wanted to take to sort of seem quite natural.
Okay. Well, thanks very much, Nathan. And like I say, if you check it out and have a look around, poke around, and hopefully, I'm sure you'll find something you'll like on there. So thank you very much, Nathan.
That's all right. Thanks. Okay, so Nathan here. I've been asked to do a reading of some of my work, just to finish this off. Just to explain, this is something. This is a story I'm going to improvise. I've never done this before, but it's something I've always wanted to do, so I thought today, even, would be the time to give it a go. It's a story that's been kicking around in my head for a while. I wrote the first few lines and then didn't get anywhere with it. But it seems to be in my brain, so I'm going to give it a go. Please bear with me. I won't give you the title until the end, as the title happens to be the last phrase. So I'm sure you'll get it at the end. But here he goes. She let the door close behind her. The lock clicked back into place and the glass rattled slightly in its frame. The sounds, although quiet, were amplified in the silent hallway. She knew that upstairs he would be asleep. His torso would be twisted within the sheets and his pale arse would be stuck up catching the light from the landing. Her tired heart rushed a little faster when she thought of him naked. She thought of going upstairs and waking him. Lie down on her back and be fucked. Her legs up in the air, let the blood drain back. But she didn't want to wake him. It was late, and he would have to wait for work soon. It had been a long night, and that dull pain in her feet was the only thing keeping her awake. So she went into the kitchen, poured herself a glass of wine, blood red wine, and she started to think to herself, had she not seen enough blood tonight? But she started drinking before she could answer. She went outside and lit a cigarette. And as the end burnt, she thought to herself about all the needles and the drips, all the bleeping machines and the piss wet, the white piss clean mattresses, the family and friends, the births and deaths, the annual leave, and the bank holidays in lieu. She thought about this until she was brought back by the burning at the end of the stick as it reached her fingers. And she thanked Christ the cigarettes were there, a suicide for the patient. She went back into the kitchen, sank the wine and climbed the stairs, turned the lights off and slipped into the darkness, stripped off and climbed beneath the sheets. And as she fell asleep, she thought to herself, as she put her hand on his naked hip, is this the loneliness of saints?